Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
So we'll have a look at the business stories making this morning's papers and online. Delighted to be joined by Caroline Bogle of Bordish Gowara and Stephen O'Leary, the founder of Alitico. You're both very welcome to the programme. Excuse me. Stephen, we might start with you. The front page of the Daily Mail: bid to send migrants back to UK is pointless. Michael McDougall giving some legal advice to the government here, basically saying that they're wasting their time.
Yeah, this is Brian Mann, the political correspondent in the Irish Daily Mail, and he's spoken to Michael McDougall about this issue. And like you say, the phrase used is a pointless exercise. And it seems to be that the key point in all of this, or the key concern, is the Rwanda policy within the UK, and the risk of onward travel or deportation to Rwanda would mean that that's going to stop or prevent people being sent from Ireland to the UK. And even if this bid is successful or it's brought through, the major concern is there's a strong likelihood it'll be challenged in the courts, which would lead to significant delays. So certainly there doesn't appear to be any quick fix, as is outlined here by Brian Mann, in terms of this story.
Reading the story, Caroline, do you think the government might reconsider its options here? Because it seems to me that this is a closed door and they're going to be just wasting time, money, resources onto something that just isn't going to work.
It's certainly a really complex situation. And I note, you know, later in that piece, the government is also saying that this is just one of several options that they're looking at the moment.
Yeah.
So they're talking about a suite of measures. But there's no doubt that it's a really complex issue. And certainly David Young, in a different article in the Daily Mail, he's referring to the UK's invitation that Ireland might join the Rwanda policy, the Taoiseach's comment on that, that's more satire than news. So,
I don't know.
Issues.
RTE is back in the spotlight, Stephen. We've got three reports, I think, coming next week. But taxpayers to top up TV licence in RTE funding pan. Fionnán Sheehan, who seems to love to write about this, is giving us it in spades this morning. I don't know what his position is with RT, but he certainly loves to put them back into print.
Well, it's certainly not the first time we've reviewed one of his pieces on this topic on this show. But what he sets out within the article is that essentially there's timing issues here, right? So we've got elections coming up in June, and there's going to be no decisions made before then, with one eye, I guess, on the electorate and how they're going to vote. But he also sets out that there were two previous options really here. So one was that you scrap the TV licence and you dip into the exchequer, or the other was to get better at just collecting TV licences. And what Sheehan points out is that, according to his sources, there's now a new option on the table. And that's,
which is the blended one.
Yeah, it's this kind of hybrid model or a compromise solution. There's lots of terms being used here. I think the key point in it for me, from what I'm reading from Sheehan, is that it won't require legislation.
Right.
And that means that the government can actually take action here. And the other kind of key element here is that it's a central, or would be a central, independent media pot. So it wouldn't be exclusively for RTE.
And so we might even get something out of it.
Yeah, they talk about local media, local news. And certainly we know that there is a need to help fund these local news organisations. So definitely it won't be exactly as it was before. But what it will ultimately end up being isn't clear yet either.
Well, it's also, what is clear is that we, the taxpayer, end up paying. I think that's, it's just a matter of what way it's collected.
Yeah, and Sheehan talks about revenue, and apparently that is something that no one wants. Revenue don't want it, government don't want it, but ultimately if that's what it took, I think that's an option they will kind of consider. But ultimately, I think what was interesting too was seeing that Catherine Martin and Micheál Martin took very differing views in this. So Catherine Martin would appear to be in favour of scrapping it, but there are comments not attributed to Micheál Martin, but attributed to conversations around that people value things they contribute to. And that ultimately, if you scrap this, well, what else are you going to scrap? Are you going to make people pay for anything? Was kind of one of the lines put out. But certainly it wouldn't feel that there's absolute consensus across the various parts of government on how to tackle this.
Caroline, the Irish Times is telling us, Pat Leahy, actually, that RTE will face greater government oversight in the future. I suppose that's not surprising, given that they're effectively being bailed out here.
Indeed, and I know that Professor Niamh Brennan's report is due imminently. I think, anticipating up to 90 recommendations in that report, which I think will cover all of the expected areas. I think what's important here isn't necessarily, you know, who's the watchdog or how it's done. It's the cultural change that's ongoing in RT at the moment. You know, there's been huge work done there. And I think that, you know, this should be a very useful signpost for them. But I certainly think that, you know, getting it onto that financially stable footing in terms of the funding model, that's going to be absolutely critical. I think what's really interesting is looking, you know, globally at the way a lot of broadcasters are funded. There's about a 50-50 split between whether they're exchequer funded or whether they're license funded.
Yeah.
So actually the hybrid model is quite an interesting take on that. And I think, you know, to be able to lower that license fee as suggested, maybe collected through revenue, it's certainly an interesting approach that might be the middle ground.
I think the problem with, you know, sitting the two models side by side is where the problem arises, that to be an independent broadcaster, you know, that's paid solely by the license fee is fine. But once you start bringing in commercials into it straight away, you're into murky water.
Absolutely. And certainly, you know, the governance around non-commercial semi-states in particular is very strong, but commercial semi-states also. So there is a bit of an identity issue there in terms of exactly where that line is and how much commercial autonomy you actually have and what your responsibility to the taxpayer is.
Yeah.
So it's very tricky. But that report should be very interesting for them, certainly given a roadmap going forward.
Stephen, blow for borrowers, ECB to limit number of rate cuts this year. We're also being told in the Irish Examiner that the ECB's Philip Lane warning against raising hopes over future interest rate costs. There's always a dialogue around this that, you know, a lot of people, like a lot of businesses, a lot of economies, a lot of banking, like they hang on every word around this, stocks, shares, investments. So, you know, the narrative, I suppose, needs to be, from Philip Lane's point of view, I suppose, needs to be controlled.
It does. This is a really interesting example. This is Charlie Weston writing in The Independent. And it's one of those really interesting articles that if you read it from the headline to the end, it's a very negative story, right? This is bad news. If you read it from the end to the start, this is actually an incredibly positive story. There's buried deep inside here some really good news if you're someone who's either...
Give us the good news.
Well, there's competition in the market. So we know that, for example, AIB, EBS and Haven have upped the cash incentive for switchers from 2,000 to 3,000 euros, as well as introducing reductions with their new green rates. Bank of Ireland has introduced a range of discount on its fixed rates. There's now a new flat variable rate from them. PTSB have cut some of their rates. Avant Money is reducing their rates. And there's going to be a technical adjustment to rates in September that will benefit tracker holders. So there's actually loads of really good news, but you have to get to the very end and pass the blow for borrowers part to find it. So I'm not for a second saying that those who are borrowers or want to be borrowers aren't facing challenges at the moment. And rates are certainly very high versus 2 years ago. The fact that these are going to be the first rates in all rate cuts in almost 2 years indicates the challenges that are there within the market. But it's not all bad news.
Yeah.
And I think certainly the report by Charlie Weston also saying that this is going to obviously positively impact those people who are with the vulture funds is obviously really positive. Still 70,000 people impacted by that. And you're absolutely right. It is indicating, you know, the price growth is definitely starting to ease. We're seeing moderating wage pressures, drop in inflation. So there is some certainly good news buried in this article.
No, absolutely. And it's you know, so many things are connected to interest rates. You know, the cost of borrowing, whether companies will invest, whether, like, there's big picture stuff, you know, always, you know, rests on the back of this. So any debate about them, you know, needs to be carefully considered. Good news, Caroline, with Tara Mines reopening from July, but unfortunately numbers are less than they were. I think it's going to be looking like about 400 full-time jobs where there was 600, but at least I suppose, you know, there are 400 jobs have been saved here.
Yeah, absolutely. This is covered in several of the papers this morning. Anne-Marie Walsh in The Independent, noting that it'll be open after 1 year. It'll open again in July. As you say, 400 employees of the 200 not returning, seeking redundancy for 150 of them. And I think the really good news there, I suppose, is that the three unions are all united in their support of this.
Yeah.
And that they'll be restructuring how they do business. And Emmett Malone in the Irish Times also saying, you know, this has been a really difficult time for those staff, really hard for them to have lived through this over the last year, and that they really welcome this deal and the go forward position, and the Swedish owner coming out very positively talking about the future, and all around a good news story, I think.
Yeah, because I think, Stephen, often when we see, you know, temporary closures, you know, getting out of that status, like, it is often a story where it actually, it's a long goodbye. Mm. This is a good news story in that they actually have managed to reopen the business.
Yeah, and look, I think it's a testament to the unions, you know, and to that kind of collective bargaining and that idea of kind of bringing people together to have their voice heard. Look, if you're one of the 150 people who's, you know, facing voluntary redundancy or being asked about it, I'm sure it's not an easy time. But I guess one of the positives we read here is that the Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment, Peter Burke, not only welcoming the announcement, obviously, but also committing publicly that the government will support those workers who are facing redundancy, including kind of retraining, job search assistance and so on. And that's key. Mm-hmm. These people now who are not returning, the 150 who are being asked to take voluntary redundancy, they need to be supported and upskilled, and other opportunities need to be made available to them.
And I see as well that 50 people have actually left the business since the mine was closed on a temporary basis. So hence they're only looking for 150 rather than 200. Yeah, okay, well, it's good news and delighted to see them open again. Caroline, this is a story, I'm often fascinated about the narrative around wind farms in Ireland and the narrative around us being the greatest resource in the world for offshore wind, and yet we only have a very small number of turbines on the Arklow Bank. So we were told today about four sites for a cluster of powerful offshore wind farms revealed. This is off Wexford and Waterford. There were already some announced. But, you know, before we talk about this article, can you just give us a high level, as somebody who's close to this in your own business of Bordish Gawara, and again, one of the, I suppose, interested parties, can you give us a high level understanding of what's happening in this sector at the moment?
Sure. At the moment, we get about 40% of our electricity from renewable sources, onshore renewable sources. So wind turbines generally, and, yeah, and solar panels and so on. We want to double that to 80% as a nation. But then we also need to get power for heat and transport, which are almost entirely fossil fuels now at this point. So there's an enormous importance for us to have that energy security for lots of different reasons, notwithstanding, you know, what's happened since 2022 and the Ukraine and the instability that creates. So the government now, for the first time, has come up with a plan to do this in a plan-led approach. So what they've done is they're developing maps called Designated Maritime Area Plans, or DMAPs.
Okay.
And these are areas off the coast, and they've started with one off the south coast, southeast coast. And what they're doing is looking at a specific area of the water and trying to plan it in a way similar to what you would on land.
Okay.
So to say, this should go here. So renewable energy should go here. Fishing can happen here. Transport can happen here. Leisure can happen here. A lot of them will interconnect. But it's this plan-led approach. It's the first time that we've ever done it. So what this is this is the first ever spatial plan for renewable energy. So this is being reported on by both Kevin O'Sullivan in the Irish Times and also by Caroline O'Doherty in the Indo. And they're both talking about the four proposed sites within this DMAP, within this area off the southeast coast of Waterford, which are proposed for offshore wind projects.
Yeah.
And the idea is that they can develop these multi-activity plans. So they're consulting at the moment on the proposed plan and really the environmental impacts of those plan. But it's really important that we do progress with this. And as you said, I've been doing it as part of my work with the seafood community and the fishermen, just to ensure that there's balance and that there's good mutual understanding. And that is certainly the case. It's going forward. It's going okay. forward well. There's good.
Thank you for that, because I think that's helpful, Stephen. Because you kind of wonder when you hear the narrative around offshore wind, you know, that we should be the best in the world with our resources, but yet we seem to be so slow in getting there.
Yeah, and yet there are kind of these green shoots that seem to be coming through in this reporting. So I think one of the really interesting things we see here are the tangibles, right, in terms of volume. So there's talks that once or when this infrastructure is in place, it could account for up to 20% of the energy we consume or the electricity we consume as a nation each day, which is a really easy to understand and kind of number. But also how soon we might see the first of these four sites actually come online. And, you know, Eamon Ryan, perhaps with a level of optimism, but I would hope maybe some realism too, is suggesting that very close to 2030, this could actually be up and running. And if that was the case, you know, within the, let's say, like the cycle of the next government, to think that this could be something we could be benefiting from is, I mean, it's good news.
Yeah, absolutely. Caroline, slow-moving second-hand home market is a drag on mortgage lending. Mover mortgages have fallen substantially over the past year due to a lack of options for people looking to upsize. Again, some debate in the Irish Times on this today.
Yeah, I mean, this just seems to keep on going, the challenges that we have around the housing in this country. We've got Cantillon in the Irish Times talking about the fact that we've had, despite the ramp up in the house building that we've had, which has been really positive for first time buyers, that we're having a drop off in the mortgage approvals, which is down 16%. A significant drop in those who are remortgaging, which is some ways to be expected. But I think the concerning one that he's pointing to here is the drop in the mover mortgages, as you said, the lack of secondhand homes. So people are upsizing. They want to live in established urban areas. The availability is just not there for them. A drop, a huge drop there of 17.5% year on year. And Davies coming out yesterday saying that the secondhand market is illiquid, which is a fairly stark commentary from
illiquid
them,
is a strong accounting term, Stephen.
It is. And I think, you know, there's a close connection between this and the rates, the interest rate story that we covered a little bit earlier, because in lots of ways, the two are interconnected.
Yeah.
The reasons that moving isn't happening is concerns about if you're on a good rate now, would you really move on to something a little bit higher? So something needs to happen because they're fairly stark percentage decreases year on year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're a golfer, Stephen, but a story by Colin Sheridan today in the Irish Examiner caught my eye because rough times for golf clubs as constant rain hits halts play. And it, like, if we think back of the last 8 weeks, it's been damp, it's been wet, it's been horrendous for farmers. We covered the farmers last week on this show. But, you know, when we think about things like golf courses, while they're amenities, they're also businesses. They're also places that need, you know, to trade and to go about their business. And they've been absolutely annihilated with the weather.
They have. I'm a golfer, not a particularly good one, but a passionate
one. A bit like myself.
And actually, I was a golf course employee. So I grew up in Cork. I worked in the old Head of Kinsale. It was my summer job. So I've, you know, I know what it's like to go and see the course washed out and what that's like for the greenskeepers and everyone else involved. There's no doubting that the weather, particularly at the start of this year, has had a really significantly negative impact on golf courses. This is another piece, though, again, where if you started at the end, you would get a slightly different picture because there's buried deep here an awful lot of positivity. The idea that I think junior memberships, junior golf programs remain amongst the most oversubscribed of any sport in the country, which is incredible. And the successes we're having, like Rory McIlroy, Leona Maguire, Shane Lowry, Seamus Power, that's really enhanced
popularity. Always good for the game.
So there is, again, there's good news here, but there's no doubting the challenges that both public and private courses face at the moment when you're closed for such long periods of time trying to get it ready and available for players.
And the real struggle here is that if you allow people play on, you know, wet grass or wet ground, the damage that's caused to recover is significant.
I think there's an interesting piece. I also worked in a golf club. I started my career in Luttrellstown Golf Club.
I spent several years there. Deep roots in golfing on this paper review.
But I think there's a really interesting piece in here as well that Colin Sheridan points out, which is he talks to three course managers or golf professionals. He talks to Gary Madden in Glenlow Abbey in Galway, Eamon O'Donnell in Drumoland, and then Eileen O'Grady in Woodstock. And Eileen's experience is very different from the other two because they're backed by big corporate American investors who have the ability to in some way mitigate some of these issues with, right. you know, advanced technology. Whereas in Woodstock and Ennis, you know, Eileen is saying, and there is, she's reported as saying that it's really challenging. They had to close for 2 months and they're really struggling there. So some of the innovations that are being reported in terms of indoor facilities and so on, you know, they're not going to be available to some of those smaller clubs who are really important to those sort of coastal communities that they're operating in, many of them.
Yeah, I suppose like it's amazing how quickly we kind of forget. It's a bit like the farmers when we had some sun last week. You know, you kind of embrace the here and now. So hopefully this has just been a blip of the last 3 months.
Well,
and that they can recover sufficiently.
It's a reminder, though, too, of the role that the climate plays in so many livelihoods. Like you said, we've talked about this from a farming point of view, but anyone who's got a business that involves the outdoors, the changes in the climate are really kind of having a negative impact.
Yeah.
Now, it's a big day in Croke Park today, Caroline. I don't know if you're going, but Matt Cooper is a little piece of provocation here in today's Irish Mail, because he's suggesting why Croker should be the home of Irish rugby. Now, I don't know, you could be assaulted with a hurl if you said that too loud, but what are your own views on this piece?
Well, you know, this is a really fun piece, isn't it, by Matt Cooper in the Mail today. Lots of tongue-in-cheek here about referring to how people will and will not get to Croke Park, depending on what parts of the country they're coming from. You know, I think it's isn't it really interesting to see those extra 30,000 seats he's reporting sold out immediately?
Yeah.
I think the question was initially, gosh, would those seats go?
And no problem.
It certainly
selling
shows
them.
We are an absolutely sports mad nation, because, you know, certainly I think you could fill the Aviva and Croke Park every week. But the bigger question that we were talking about earlier is, you know, what does this mean for other places in the country that have multiple stadia in these small towns? Because certainly collaborating and doing things like this together, it makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I remember with fondness and well the period between 2007 and 2010 when the rugby was played there, and we saw some unbelievable games against England, against France. But I suppose, while every place maybe has its own identity, it is nice to see that if there's a big game, you know, that, and there's huge interest, that you could trade up to 82,000 seats, regardless of the sport.
It also shows the level of collaboration, cooperation that now exists in our sport relative to 20 years ago. I just don't think this is a conversation that would have been entertained 20 years ago. And yet now, it's in everyone's commercial interests. It's definitely in the interests of the fans. I think it's going to be a phenomenal occasion. And I would hope that this is a sign that we will see more of this into the future, that at moments when there are clashes or unavailability of certain stadia, that the different codes and the different sports come together and actually work to put on the best possible kind of stage for both fans and players.
Okay. I think we'll we wish all our listeners well, and go out there and enjoy the game, because I think it's going to be a cracker. So I'd like to thank my guests, Caroline Bokel of Bordish Gawara and Stephen O'Leary of Olitigo. Thanks for a great review of the papers, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.